Hello, everyone. Welcome to Super Metal World. This is Michael.
And this is Ty.
So this week we are going to go back to another In Context. This one specifically is going to be about Korn's self-titled and debut album, Korn.
Yeah, this is the best album by far that we've done for an In Context.
Yes, of course. This one is generally regarded as a supremely excellent and breakthrough album.
Yeah, really a game changer. So I'm really excited about that because previously, not to take away from our other In Context, because it's still good material that you guys should definitely listen to. It's the other one we did was on Saint Anger and kind of putting into context the drama surrounding that one. And the other one after that was So Far So Good, So What by Megadeth. So we always do bands that mean a lot to us. And Korn means a lot to me. Just to give a little Korn cred for the Korn fans listening to this, Korn was the goes hand in hand with my introduction to metal. The first metal albums I listened to were Metallica's The Black Album and Korn's Issues. So Korn's Issues has a very special place in my heart, and it's actually my favorite Korn album, which I don't think is too unusual.
No, that's great.
Was it kind of the same way for you?
I think my first exposure to Korn was actually, as far as like actually getting deep into an album, was See You on the Other Side. So it was a little late for me.
But at the same time, like, I really listen. I think that's somewhat unusual. I don't think that's a bad album. It's definitely like where the band kind of went in a different direction as far as their music. A little more groovy album.
I think that was the first album without Head after his departure.
Oh,
so I think that was probably a reason for the slight change.
And also that album kind of came to prominence or blew up, I guess, when we were in high school. So that's what, there's always nostalgia.
Yeah, of course. That of course.
These things. So, cause I can remember Coming Undone playing at like every athletic event. So, anyway, regardless, Korn does mean a lot to me. They're one of my favorite bands. I know they're one of yours as well.
Mm-hmm.
So really excited to get into the debut album. I gotta admit, it took me a long time to actually get around to listening to Korn's debut album. I mean, I have listened to it. This wasn't my first time listening to it prepping for this, but I listened to a lot of other Korn before I got to the first Korn album. What about you?
No, same. Absolutely. Like for whatever reason, Korn's first album and Slipknot's first album, I guess, you know, similar bands in their styles and whatnot, but like those specifically, yeah, Korn's first album I didn't get into until, I don't know, a while after enjoying Korn, for sure.
I want to say I didn't get into it until college, and I had known about Korn since like I was 14 or 15 years old, so it took me a long time to actually listen to their first album, which is crazy to me.
Oh, yeah.
But I was so focused on their later work. Anyway, so before we get into Korn and their debut album, so what In Context episodes are going to contain, just so you guys kind of know what we're going to talk about, we're going to talk about everything that we can surrounding the album as far as how the album got made, and talk about all the songs individually. We'll talk about what was going on in the world of metal in 1994, and kind of just in the world of music, what the climate was, and we'll discuss kind of our take on the album, our favorite parts of the album, the legacy of the album. Basically, we dig as deep as we can on Korn's debut album, so stick around for that. We are now on Spotify, finally!
Yeah!
I mean, that only took like half a year.
Seriously.
So that's exciting. That we can offer that now. So now you can find us on iTunes, Spotify, literally anywhere you get your podcasts. We are now finally, we can now finally say
that.
Like,
that was like the last one, the last little bit that we needed to get, but now Spotify changed their approach with some things, and now it's like very easy for, you know, anyone not huge or very official to get things up. So they respect the little guys like us now.
Finally, because Spotify is, I'm very loyal to Spotify. I've been loyal to Spotify since, oh gosh, 2011 or 12.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
So it's nice to finally be on there, because this is Spotify's where I listen to all my podcasts, and it was really frustrating me that I couldn't listen or check up on our own podcast on my favorite thing to listen to podcasts. So thankfully we're on there and everywhere else. Just search Super Metal World. If this is your first time listening, thank you so much for listening. We hope you continue to listen and spread the word of the podcast to everybody you know. We talk about a variety of topics. Excuse me. Last week we covered Tenacious D had a web series for their new album, and we covered that. But we talk about a lot of things, usually all pertaining to heavy metal or hard rock or music that we love, which happens to be, like I said, hard rock and heavy metal. We have a website, www.supermetalworld.com. A lot of great content on there. Go check it out. Not only do we have podcasts on there, but we have articles. Some of them are showcasing independent small metal bands that I think you guys would really enjoy. And some of them are about things like Adam Sandler dropping his Netflix special, which contained a lot of music. And Sandler always has that grungy grit, so that's how that fits into our formula. So there is a variety of things there. We're on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Search Super Metal World. As always, go to iTunes and give us a rate and review. Subscribe to us. That really helps get our name out there. It's really beneficial to podcasts, especially small podcasts like ours that we want to be larger and get to more people. Follow us now on Spotify.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we have I already said we have a website. We do have an email as well, supermetalworld@gmail.com. Please send us an email there. We do have to give a shout-out to one of our new fans who started listening to us when we started talking about Tenacious D, and his Reddit name is Gale Force Rob. So, Gale Force Rob.
Shouts.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate all the kind words.
Yeah, exactly. You're like the Pizza Guy Lee in Tenacious D, Mystic of Destiny.
Yes.
Dudes, that was badass. So, we very much appreciate that. So let's get into some Korn. Horns high.
Horns high.
So before we get into talking about Korn's debut album, something that happened really recently and ties in nicely with what we're talking about, Jonathan Davis sat down on Jamie Josta's 400th episode of, I think it's called Josta Show?
That sounds right, yeah.
Something like that. And we know Jamie Josta, he is the lead singer of the band Hatebreed. Anyway, they talked for a long time regarding Korn, of course, and how massive they were in the late 90s. And it got to a point in the conversation where Davis made the proclamation that he doesn't think rock bands could ever reach those heights of popularity anymore, that Korn reached, and, you know, Limp Bizkit and bands like that, when they were kind of changing the game of music. So the quote goes like this: "Can whatever the big bands that are out now, can that have an impact, having that cosign, in reference to the smaller groups like Incubus, whose careers were launched when titans like Korn took them on tour?" Davis responds, "No. Not to the same caliber as, like, we could. I've always said this last batch, Korn, Deftones, Bizkit, all those bands from that time, that was the last guard of the time of the big real rock bands. That time has come and gone. No one's ever going to do it like we ever did. No one's ever going to have that experience. It was larger than life. We were up against pop bands, dude. I'm not trying to be arrogant or anything like that. Us against the pop bands, us against the Britney Spears and the Backstreet Boys, and then we were so embraced by the hip-hop community. When we played the Apollo, Puff Daddy was there, Busta Rhymes, Lil' Kim, you name it. All the East Coast rappers came, and it was really embraced by all of them. We did stuff with Dre, stuff with Snoop. At that time, that crossover, I haven't seen that, and I don't think I'll see it again." So what's your take on hearing that for the first time? Because I know you hadn't actually heard this quote until right now.
I don't know. I mean, no one's ever going to do it like we ever did. Like, that seems... I mean, I don't believe that. I don't believe that.
Like, no, and like, if he's being very specific to nobody's ever going to sound like Korn and blow up like Korn, then he's right.
Yeah, of course. I mean, Korn's like got just like this incredibly unique sound. I don't know that there's going to be, I don't know that we're going to see as successful of a crossover. Like, like Korn had with like the artists that he's mentioning, like Dre and Snoop. Like that might not happen, but I mean, to say something's never going to happen usually means that it's going to happen. You know what
I
mean?
It's hard for me to understand how to take this, because the new metal era is a very controversial but successful era for metal music. But we'll get into that later discussing new metal. But it's, you know, he is right in the sense that the era that came after him, when new metal kind of really fell off the face of the earth, and metalcore kind of took over. And when I'm talking metalcore, I'm talking, you know, like the new wave of American heavy metal with Lamb of God and Avenged Sevenfold and Killswitch Engage, and kind of all the old guard of metal bands like Metallica and Slayer, they started actually making good music again, or maybe not good music is the right word, but kind of returning to their roots.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I don't think that that era has been as commercially successful as the new metal era. So in that sense, he's right. You know, like nobody has yet to, you know, you don't see Ghost up there battling against Post Malone.
Right.
So I get what he's saying. I just think that you can't put an absolute like that. He doesn't know what's going to happen.
No, no. That's my biggest problem with it. Like, I mean, I guess it's interesting. It makes us talk about it, right?
To say that it's
never going to happen again. I mean, because rap is just as popular right now. Like, hip hop is just as popular as it's ever been. Like, I mean, isn't this kind of a great opportunity for like heavy music to have like crossovers with it, right? Because like they were doing crossovers with like a lot of like old school gangster rap artists, and like seems like now is a pretty good opportunity to kind of build those relationships with the two genres together again.
And the other thing is that we don't know, you know, like rock and metal, they could go on a completely different direction that we don't even know about, and it's going to explode, you know, like
just like Korn did.
Exactly. So I love Jonathan Davis. I think he's, what he's saying is can get interpreted a lot of different ways. And I don't think he meant to say like the whole, you know, it's so cliche to be like, rock and metal's dead. It's right. Never going to be the same.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, like, I definitely think it hasn't hit the height of popularity since the new metal days, for sure. You know, like, things aren't going platinum like, you know, like, for example, Linkin Park's Meteora or even their Hybrid Theory album. Those albums went, like, so many times over platinum. You know, it's been a while since, like, heavier music has had that kind of commercial impact.
Right.
And this isn't the 80s, you know, we don't have Def Leppard and yada yada. But at the same time, you know, if we're talking Limp Bizkit, if we're talking Linkin Park, if we're talking Def Leppard, there's a lot of poppy elements into that music. So it's not like it was Lamb of God selling 10 million albums.
Right.
You know, I don't know that that will ever
happen. No, that's a little bit too abrasive for most of the tender ears of the population.
Yeah. So anyway, you guys, I don't know, let us know what you think about that. I just thought it was really interesting and kind of topical since we're since he just said that like a couple days ago and we're currently talking about Korn. I love Jonathan Davis. I think it's good for him to be confident. And what Korn accomplished was really game changing because, you know, the elements that they mixed and whatever, Korn is just Korn, and they were able to be so successful doing it. And I think they inspired a lot of, even I've read that like the hip hop artists today or the mumble rappers, whatever you want to call them, a lot of them are inspired by bands like Korn. So it's interesting.
Yeah. No, I mean,
I'm not exactly happy that they created mumble rap or helped inspire mumble rappers, but right, you know, right. Whatever.
Yeah. No, I guess, thus far he's not wrong. To say that it will never happen. To say that it will never happen is a little I think it's a little aggressive, but who knows?
And it's I don't want to live that way. That's sad. I can't think that it'll never happen. I would like something crazy to happen again in the heavier music community. Because it's kind of fun when It's kind of fun when you see Korn up there in the sales, you know, against the Backstreet Boys or something. It'd be fun to see something like that again.
Yeah, definitely.
So anyway, getting to Korn, the debut album from Korn. This was released in October 11th of 1994. So what's that been now?
14 years?
Yeah. 14th years.
24 years. Geez.
24 years. I was going to say 14. Good Lord. Seem right. Yeah, so that's a while ago. So they released this on Immortal. And Immortal is also known for Incubus, 30 Seconds to Mars, Scary Kids Scaring Kids, which was a band that was somewhat popular when we were in junior high. And yeah, I
it's
think
like a 2005 emo band, right, basically?
Yeah, and I think they were on the path to being a pretty big band, but I think the lead singer or somebody important died in that band. But anyway,
wow.
This was recorded in, Korn was recorded in Indigo Ranch Studios in Malibu, California. The place has since burned down, and Jonathan Davis said he has visited it, and he was going to take his kids there to like say, like, hey, here's where Dad recorded his first album. And he was kind of horrified to see that it had burned down, and all that remained was a cactus with, like, I don't know if it was a plaque of people's names or people scratched their names into the cactus, but name still was left there.
Hmm. And he didn't know about it?
Yeah, he didn't know about it, apparently, somehow. Yeah, he said he drove up there with his kids, and he realized...
it's not there.
as they realized. You think somebody would have told them.
Right, yeah, I mean, weird.
Anyway, it was produced by Ross Robinson, who also recorded Korn's demo, Nadermeyer's Mind. And we'll talk about that too, actually. It's the album that's considered to really have established the nu metal genre and really launched this whole movement, as a lot of bands take influence from it, I guess. Although you could also definitely argue that Anthrax was way ahead of this movement, incorporating rap into metal in the 80s. So, but Korn definitely does not sound like Anthrax. This was a different kind of blending. The album's themes include child abuse, drug abuse, bullying, and I think you have more on the album cover, so I'm going to leave that for you later.
Yeah.
Right? Because you wrote a little segment on that.
Yep, I got a little, some stuff on it.
So the album cover is pretty iconic. I'll leave it at that, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. For the most part, it's really well received. Not by Rolling Stone, although we also pulled like this really great feature from Rolling Stone where they talked to Korn years later about their debut album. And of course, now they're great. You guys
yeah.
are great.
Yeah.
We gave
yeah.
your album 2 stars at the time, but you guys are awesome. And there was some other guy from like, it was like the Calgary Herald or something, some Canadian guy who he didn't like the album either. And he said that Jonathan Davis sounded like a derivative of Phil Anselmo and Eddie Vedder. I don't know. I don't really. Maybe a little Phil Anselmo. I don't know if I really hear Eddie Vedder in him
there's,
at all.
There's some bits that I was going to get into later about that.
Okay.
There's certain moments on this album where
you can maybe see that.
Yeah.
So as far as like how successful the album was, in 1996, the album went gold. And Ozzy was the one who presented it to them with, like, some champagne. Hey, you guys want to go to... I don't know what it is.
That was at an Ozfest, too, right? Like, they played at Ozfest in 96, and he, like, presented it to them while they were there.
Yeah, and I think Ozzy also let them open for him.
That's pretty cool.
And that was big for them getting their name out. And, of course, Ozzy has been known for helping to blow Metallica up, because he brought them out when they were on their Master of Puppets tour. So Ozzy's helped raise up some pretty important bands. In fact, two of probably the most important bands in metal. So it since went double platinum in the U.S. and over 10 million worldwide, which actually surprised me.
Yeah, that's quite a few.
It peaked, the Billboard 200, it peaked at number 72, which is pretty impressive considering this song contains, or this album has Daddy on it, which is like... not mainstream at all.
No.
It has a lasting legacy in the metal community, like I mentioned. It's inspired bands, you know, like Slipknot, Machine Head, Sepultura, Cold Chamber and Limp Bizkit.
Of course.
It launched Ross Robinson's producing career. It would go on to produce, or he would go on to produce Roots by Sepultura, $3 Bill Y'all by Limp Bizkit, Slipknot's debut album Slipknot and Iowa. So I'm not sure what songs are on $3 Bill Y'all by Limp Bizkit, but Roots and Slipknot's debut in Iowa, those are some pretty important metal albums.
Yeah, definitely.
Rolling Stone later described Korn as one of the greatest or the most important records of the last 20 years that we gave 2 stars. And in 2008, I just think it's funny that they can just like change their mind like that. I guess it's just one critic that from Rolling Stone that happened to give it 2 stars.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, you know, you probably don't realize, maybe you don't realize when you're listening to this album, this like album that's not like anything else, like you don't expect it to resonate like it's going to with listeners. I don't know. Maybe they just, I guess sometimes you just totally miss the mark.
Yeah, I think so too. And I'm mostly giving them shit because at the same time, you know, we do some of this stuff where we're reviewing things and you never, you know, like you said, like this literally nothing sounded like this. And we'll get into the albums released, the metal albums certainly released this year in 94. There was nothing out that sounded like Korn. Nothing.
No.
So they came way out of left field, and I can't imagine listening to it as a critic being like, what the hell am I listening to? Like, you know, you're either really going to think it's new and edgy and give it a great review or think this shit sucks.
Yep.
So in 2018, Loudwire, you know, how much stock you put in Loudwire lists is, I don't put a lot of stock in them, but it named it the greatest new metal album of all time, which, I mean, kind of duh.
Genre. Yeah, like, kind of like, yeah.
It's kind of like calling Black Sabbath's debut the greatest metal album of all time.
I mean, you know? I mean, that's an interesting one because does that imply that maybe it's because they're also considering all the context around that album, but like, does that mean that Korn's debut album is Korn's best album? Because surely like Issues is a new metal album. And
yeah, see, that's why, because they always would say like, well, if you don't have Korn's first album, you don't have Issues, you know,
yeah,
like,
yeah, of course,
which I take issue with because I personally do not think this is their strongest album. I really do enjoy this album. It's not one I go back to as much as some others.
Right. No, so, I agree.
So I don't know. I think it's interesting because I too don't think that Black Sabbath's first album is the greatest metal album of all time. Just because you created it doesn't mean it's the best thing right away.
But if you see it as number one on the list, like you're a dick for arguing about it.
Yeah, right. Because like, it's like, well, they created it, man. Right. You wouldn't have Master of Puppets without
you can't win that argument.
Yeah. So to me, it's like, is this Korn's greatest album? I don't think so. I think they perfected new metal on other albums that you would consider, that I would consider better than Korn. Or than their first album, I should say. But anyway, that's besides the point, I guess. Jonathan Davis has named this as his favorite album. He actually ranked his albums. I can't remember what publication, but he ranked his albums, so that's kind of interesting to see that. In 2017, Rolling Stone actually ranked it number 30 of the 100 best metal albums of all time.
Wow.
And spoiler alert, I bet you Black Sabbath was number one. And I bet you Master of Puppets was number 2. I actually would almost bet money on that right now. And while we're talking about the Loudwire list, I just got to mention this briefly. If you want a good laugh, if you are a Metallica fan, go listen to their, or go read their list of ranking all Metallica songs. Like, it is terrible.
It's just, it's not great, guys. It's not great.
It's so bad on every, like, on so many levels, it is terrible. Like, how can you rate To Live Is To Die, Metallica's worst song, when they've written Invisible Kid? You know, like, how is Invisible Kid, like, 30 spots better? Or how is Invisible Kid better than Shortest Straw? Are you fucking kidding me?
It's like 150-ish songs, right? And Shortest Straw is like 111 or something like that?
Yeah, it's terrible. Like, you lose all credibility. Have you listened to Shortest Straw? Like, are you kidding me?
That song is anyway, righteous.
It's so good. It's so good. It's like one of the songs I always go to. And they have like Of Wolf and Man is really low. I was like, really? That's like one of the best songs on the Black Album. Anyway, it's a terrible list. So go read it just to like laugh. And they also, just another spoiler alert, they put Damage Inc. as the number one Metallica song. Are you fucking kidding me? Like, in what world is that the number one Metallica song? That's a great song, but like,
I don't know, man. I don't know. It's,
isn't it obvious that like you got to put Master of Puppets probably up there?
Yeah, or... I mean,
come on, that's so bad. Anyway, we'll stop shitting on Loudwire, but seriously, it's a good laugh. Go read it. Anyway, so that's kind of all the basics for Korn's debut album. After recording this particular album, they went and toured with Biohazard, which I listened to Biohazard, and they're just a really poor man's Machine Head and House of Pain, who did like jump around, that song.
Yeah.
And I guess according to the drummer at the time, what's his first name? Silvera is his last name.
David.
Yeah, he said that they were not really friendly. Biohazard and House of Pain, they were assholes. They had like strange rules, and they wouldn't let Korn hang out with them. So, fuck you, Biohazard, and fuck you, House of Pain. Who cares about either of you? And I guess we can never have them on our podcast. So.
Get on my face.
I don't watch you guys anyway. So I don't know. Maybe we can get into some music-related events that occurred in 94, the same year that Korn dropped their debut album.
Sure,
I think you got a list of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's like actually like an impressive amount of shit that happened in 1994. So on the... 94 is like in the throes of the grunge era, right? And Alice in Chains releases their album Jar of Flies.
Yeah.
My notes here says or, and that doesn't seem right.
Jar of Flies.
That's got jar or flies.
You take your pick.
That's got tracks like Nutshell and No Excuses on it. Black Sabbath.
Two of my favorites, by the way, Alice in Chains songs.
Black Sabbath released an album called Cross Purposes. Dio on vocals, not well received. I've never listened to it. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Cannibal Corpse released their fourth album, The Bleeding. I didn't realize that Cannibal Corpse had released four albums by 94. Like, that's a little band. I didn't realize they were that old.
Also, is that the band that we laugh at the Radio Disney?
Oh yeah, yeah.
YouTube videos.
Evisceration Plague by Cannibal Corpse, the Disney edition.
So disturbing.
It's so good.
It's actually more disturbing because you can understand what he's talking about.
Yeah. I can't listen to that song anymore. Like the actual version of it, it ruined it for me.
It's pretty hilarious. Yeah, Google Radio Disney Cannibal Corpse. Really funny. Anyway,
Converge, Halo in a Haystack. That's our Converge's debut album. That is actually considered a precursor to metalcore. So there's a lot of like early like or cursory albums releasing. For example, Emperor releasing In the Nightside Eclipse, which is a landmark black metal album. Dio releasing Strange Highways, again, not well received. Like a lot of the old school rock suffered hard in the 90s. Like no one could do anything right.
Yeah, like Dio was, you know, Dio, Black Sabbath. I even think that is it Bruce Dickens or Bruce Dickinson? Who's the lead singer? Who was
Dickinson?
Iron Maiden. Okay, I think he released like a solo album. It was just a hard time for the old guard of metal, and we all know that like Metallica was doing like a more hard rock, bluesy, gritty thing in the 90s, and Megadeth was, well, they released Euthanasia, which was commercially successful for them. And, the bands just weren't releasing, they were going in different directions, I guess. Grunge really threw metal for a loop. And, yeah, the big bands just didn't have the impact like they used to. It was I noticed that was kind of a interesting year for black metal because Cradle of Filth also released The Principles of Evil Made Flesh, which was their debut album, and Dimmu Borgir. I don't know how to pronounce that.
I've never figured that out either. I don't know how to pronounce that, but that's like a symphonic metal, right?
Yeah, and they released For All Tid, I guess. And I think you can kind of consider them somewhat black metal as well. So, interesting year for black metal. POD, the Youth of the Nation, that artist, they released their first album, Snuff the Punk. I have never listened to it. I don't know if that's a recommender or not. And I don't know if they were kind of rapping in that time, too, because that would be interesting.
Oh, yeah. You know, if
POD released. Yeah. Because they were always kind of a somewhat new metal, new rock kind of band, yeah, where they had like hip hop elements.
Yeah, they were like a cleaner, more commercial new metal.
Machine Head released Burn My Eyes, which was, I think that was their debut album, wasn't it?
That sounds right.
Yeah, and I'm a big fan of that album. That was a groovy metal album, and Testament released Low. That was pretty well received. I've actually listened to that album. It's pretty good. Slayer released Divine Intervention. It had mixed reviews, and I honestly never heard of that album, and never. I looked at the track list. I was like, I've never heard of any single song on here. So sorry, Slayer fans. I'm sure there's some good ones on there, but Marilyn Manson released his debut, Portrait of American Family. Stone Temple Pilots released Purple. That had a Interstate Love song. That's got to be one of my favorite like 90s jams.
Oh yeah, yeah.
On a Sunday afternoon.
Scott Whelan had such like iconic 90s grunge voice, like, man.
And rest in peace for sure. Because Interstate Love song on what? We played that on like Rock Band or something.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, it was on one of those, wasn't it?
One of the best ones to play on Rock Band, because it's a great song to sing. Oh man. Interstate Love song. Anyway, Pantera released Far Beyond Driven. This actually was a number one album for them. Hit the Billboard Top 200. That had the songs like I'm Broken, Becoming, 5 Minutes Alone. It's also where Dimebag Darrell decided to become Dimebag Darrell instead of Diamond Darrell, which I didn't know that.
Mm, yeah, yeah. Because they were like they wanted to be like a glam band early on, right?
Yeah, yeah. Look into Pantera's early days, and I think a lot of people would be surprised to know they started out as a glam metal band, kind of. So, yeah, I think I'll let you take the other events. I think you didn't discuss. Did you discuss the big one? The guy who passed away?
Oh yeah. 94 was the year Kurt Cobain died.
Yep.
To a self-inflicted shotgun wound. There were a couple of bands that formed in 94 that are fairly significant. Those being Foo Fighters, Lacuna Coil, Lamb of God, Rammstein, Static X, and System of a Down. And I've recently picked up a little bit of Static X, and they're like, not suspiciously, but like very, very similar to Korn. Like it kind of threw me off a little bit. I was like, whoa, shit, is this like Korn? Am I listening to Korn? But, you know, obviously not, but it's Static X. So if you like Korn and you haven't listened to Static X, go listen to Static X.
So Foo Fighters literally formed the same year that Kurt passed away, huh?
Yeah, I guess.
That's interesting.
Dave Grohl,
Lamb of God.
Got to stay on that horse.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, you know, I suppose that helps with the grieving process.
I'm sure.
Just keep on working. Lamb of God, of course, one of our favorites. Rammstein's a pretty entertaining band. System of a Down was great for a while until they broke up prematurely. Anyway, so that was kind of like the landscape. And when these bands formed, I don't think they necessarily released albums that year, right?
No, I think this was like the actual, like the members got together and were like, we're in a band now.
Yeah, now we're a band.
So
yeah.
And who knows, that Lamb of God, the Lamb of God note there may mean Burn the Priest. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah, their band, obviously the name of their band before they decided to call themselves Lamb of God.
Right.
Static X probably took a lot of influence from Korn anyway. That's probably why they sound
for sure.
Formed that year. I think it's a good time for you to talk about the album art now.
So the album art, if you haven't seen it or you don't know what I'm talking about, it is basically a picture of a little girl on a swing set looking up at, like, looking up into the camera, and the camera is presumably the perspective of this person standing in front of her. However, there's a shadow cast behind behind the man in the photo. So it's like casting these long shadows. And this guy's got like these long, creepy claw knives things in his hands, or you can't actually see the guy, but it's a shadow. And the girl is sitting there just on the swing. So it's pretty cool. I think it's pretty awesome album art, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty creepy too. And yeah, she's kind of like looking like the sun's blinding her a little bit.
Yep. If you'll notice her shadow, and then Korn, like the name Korn is in the background, and the way her shadow and the K in Korn line up, it looks like she's like being strung up and hung.
Yeah, it's creative, definitely.
So Steven Stickler was the photographer for it, and he has this to say about it. So in the album cover image itself, that's the creative director's shadow. His name is Dante Ariola. He was experimenting with making like a claw shadow hand, messed up scary shapes or whatever. What we were going kind of for, but didn't really have the technology to do it, was to give it a retro smutty magazine from the 50s, 60s overall look. They wanted to desaturate it, make it look like old stock films. And he said, Epic was very wary about putting this album art out there. I'm wondering now if they would even let that album art release like today, as it sits.
That's a good question. Yeah.
I don't know.
The PC climate these days.
I mean, it's not that bad though, right? Like,
I don't think it's that bad either.
It's like really creepy, and there's a lot of like weird, like maybe implications with it that you might get, but I don't think it's like that bad.
No, I think it's kind of artfully done, really.
Yeah, definitely.
So before there was, you know, Korn's debut album, Korn, there was their demo, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but it's Niedermeyer's Mind. That was their demo. It's recorded in 1993. And this, just to give you the track listing, this had the song, the track Predictable, but it was spelt wrong. It's spelt Predactable, or Praddictable. So I don't know if it was misspelled on purpose. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It says right here, it's not a misspelling. As you can see, Michael and I, although we are very prepared, we are pretty loosey-goosey with
well,
our...
Well, here's the thing, though. Those notes say it's not a misspelling. It's how it was spelled on the cassette cover. It's not a misspelling in these notes, but who knows, maybe someone spelt it incorrectly. I don't know. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right. So anyway, it had Predictable basically on it, Blind, Daddy, and Alive. And Alive was actually remade in two ways. It was recorded into Need To on Korn's self-titled album, but it was also later put into Korn's sixth album and titled Alive off of Take a Look in the Mirror. So that's kind of interesting that would find its way into an album so late in their career.
Yeah, like for sure. Yeah, that like Take a Look in the Mirror was like, I don't know, probably like 2003, something like that.
So they recorded this demo in a place called Underground Chicken Sound. And while they were recording at Underground Chicken Sound, a group of people had been loitering around outside the studio, and the band began playing the prelude to Clown. When they began playing the song's riffs, a larger crowd gathered around, liking Korn's sound. Bassist Fieldy said it was because it sounded so different. And yes, very different, I'm sure, indeed, compared to everything they had been primed to listening to. And this was in Huntington Beach, California. Now, it's a really rare demo to find. You can't just go buy this. And I'm sure it's like some kind of, you know, bootlegged or rarity that's probably found in the most hardcore of Korn fans' libraries or showcases, I guess. And it also talks about how the band derived their name. Is actually from a fan suggestion. They suggested Korn, spelt with a C. The group initially rejected it, but then they later settled on it because they're like, fuck it, we don't have any better ideas. And Schaefer had the idea to spell the name with both a K instead of a C, and a backwards R, so it would appear as you see it today. The logo was actually designed by Jonathan Davis, as you know, kind of that handwriting, I guess, or whatever.
Chicken
that
scratch looking.
That, yeah. That you know when you think of corn. And Silveira, excuse me, explained the music makes the name because corn's a dumb name, but once we get established, it makes the name cool, which I think is pretty interesting.
I think that's totally right on. You've nailed it.
I agree. And Silveira, oh my gosh, I'm struggling. But David.
Well, yeah, we'll call him David.
David S. Pumpkins. Anyway, he's the drummer, of course, so, or was the drummer for a period of time. I think he stopped being the drummer in like 2006. So, anyway, another key component to the sound that made Korn unique that I'm surprised we haven't mentioned yet is their 7-string guitars. So,
yeah, just like was something that massive, was massively detuned, heavy riffs, for sure.
So anyway, after Niedermeyer's Mind, and I think they actually had a different vocalist, and the vocalist went away, either he had to go away for a little bit for some reason, I can't remember the exact reason, or he quit, but then they found Jonathan Davis, and everything clicked, and they felt it felt right, you know, like this is the guy we're meant to be with, this is what sets us apart, so very cool. And Jonathan Davis, through my readings, not really a metal guy. He was into like Duran Duran, and he was a goth, or you know, maybe he currently still identifies himself as a goth too today, but he was a goth in high school, and he was a goth when they met him. So I think he does enjoy metal music. I'm just saying he's not like this stereotypical metalhead.
Right.
So
right.
Anyway,
I have some notes real quick from some quotes from the Robinson, the producer, about specifically about Jonathan Davis and like understanding their relationship with like with the band, I guess. You know what I mean? Like figuring out what, like, why Jonathan Davis was so good. And Davis says, or Robinson says, Ross Robinson says, basically he was a goth kid with kind of this funky dry hair wearing monkey boots, and he was wearing Robert Smith makeup. I don't know what that means.
I don't either. Somebody.
the band wasn't dark yet. This is referencing the other three members. It had like killer grooves and good riffs, but there was some happy edge to it. And when he walked into the room, he being Jonathan Davis, it went dark and goth. Basically, during the first song to audition in the rehearsal room, he started freaking the hell out. You couldn't hear his voice, but you felt chills all over your body, and it was instantly like, oh my God, he's the one.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So that then formed the lineup that was featured on Korn and a lot of the albums after, which was Jonathan Davis on vocals and also playing the bagpipes, Brian Head Welch. He's the lead in rhythm guitars, vocals. He does backing vocals on Ball Tongue, Faggot, and Lies on this particular album. James Monkey Schaefer, he's rhythm and lead guitar. Fieldy, he is the bassist. And David S., or David Silveria, he's the drums. So that was kind of the iconic lineup of this band. So before we get too much into the album itself, I just want to talk a little bit more about nu metal, because I think just nu metal is such an interesting thing, because some of the bands that are in nu metal don't identify themselves as metal bands and don't like the term. Others embrace the term. It's just a very controversial genre, I guess.
Yeah.
So before I get into it, I was just going to ask you like kind of a general question of, do you like nu metal, or do you just like Korn?
I mean, I certainly don't seek it out. I mean, I like Korn, and like sometimes Slipknot gets kind of lumped into nu metal. They feel a little different. Like they're definitely like heavy, and they're like a metal band. that's like nu metal influenced. Like I enjoy Linkin Park from time to time, but for the most part, like I like Korn, but I don't really like nu metal.
Yeah, and that's where I sat when I was thinking about this, because you and I are definitely more, I guess, traditional in how we like metal. So we grew up with cutting our teeth with like the more of what you think of when you think of metal, like Metallica and Iron Maiden and Megadeth and Slayer, and I think that's why, although I really love Korn, and that just speaks to how unique Korn is. Although I really love Korn, I am much more a fan of the new wave of American heavy metal and the metalcore movement, I guess.
Of the
2000s.
For sure.
I like many more of those bands. And Korn I like. Limp Bizkit I like ironically. and Linkin Park, like you said. I like some Linkin Park. I don't like all of it. Korn is the one. Korn stands out.
Definitely.
By far. Other bands that are considered new metal are bands like Papa Roach, Stained, POD, Kid Rock. I mean, like
Stained.
I said, I don't really view Stained as that way, but maybe they have...
That one's interesting that they would end up in that categorization, you know?
Yeah. So, like I said, new metal, also known as polymetal, it's basically a subgenre of alternative metal. It combines heavy metal music with elements of other musical genres such as hip-hop, alternative rock, funk, industrial, and grunge. And I would say Korn definitely includes some hip-hop elements. They're a little funky. I mean, they include all those things. You know, there's some grunginess to them. And
well, the thing is, you know, basically, they created it with this album, so everything in this album is like kind of nu metal in its most pure form. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And nu metal rarely features guitar solos. And this is something that I think, to tie into our In Context episode on Saint Anger, something that even affected Metallica, because I really feel like Saint Anger was their attempt at somewhat their version of a nu metal.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like,
yeah, totally.
Taking the climate of metal and trying to do their own version of it. Anyway, many of the new metal guitarists use 7-string guitars. They're down-tuned to play a heavier sound. DJs are occasionally featured in new metal to provide instrumentation, such as sampling, turntable scratching, electronic backgrounds. Definitely that's in Limp Bizkit's music, Linkin Park, even Korn features later. Yeah, exactly. So all those elements. And it's going to include singing, rapping, screaming, growling. It's just really a blend of a lot of things.
Yep.
And they mention nu metal as one of the key genres of the new wave of American heavy metal. And I don't know. We had debated this. I think that's not 100% certain. You know, I think that's debatable. I view nu metal as its own thing, and the new wave of American heavy metal came later. That's the way I view it.
Yeah,
but I think some people just lump nu metal in there. I just think nu metal came way before that. New wave of American heavy metal, to me, is like early 2000s, maybe late 90s.
Yeah, I know that it's always widely kind of considered that, for the most part, nu metal hit and fell off of a cliff in terms of popularity in like 2002, 2003.
Yeah,
and that to me is kind of the time when like new wave of American heavy metal starts right around that early 2000s. So I mean, I guess you could view new metal as kind of like a maybe something that like kickstarted the new wave of American heavy metal, but definitely they're distinct movements.
Yeah, I agree with both those things you said. So just to put, you know, what you said into the words here. So nu metal became popular in the late 90s, and bands and artists such as Korn, Limp Bizkit, Kid Rock, they all released albums and these albums sold millions, just like Jonathan Davis said. You know, they were competing with pop stars. And the popularity continued into the early 2000s, with bands such as Papa Roach, Stain, and POD all again selling multi-platinum albums. And it came to peak with Linkin Park's diamond-selling Hybrid Theory. It went 10 times platinum.
Oh my God.
So that was kind of the peak. And by the mid-2000s, the genre, just like 80s hair metal, it became oversaturated with bands. It underperformed, and it just started to decline. And then it led to the rise of metalcore, and many new metal bands disbanded, or they kind of started to change their sound in favor of other genres. And this can be known, I would say even Slipknot was affected by this. I think they changed their sound a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree.
And not like drastically, but we both know that what is it? All Hope Is Gone, or
yes. Yep, that's the album.
I mean, that's definitely a more traditional metal album that they went for. And even early Disturbed sounds kind of new metal, and it gets more classical or traditional rock and metal as they progress. So that's interesting to note. I mean, I'm sure a lot of bands went that way as well. So what I was saying about how new metal gets criticized is that many heavy metal fans have criticized it, and they do not regard it as true heavy metal. And many new metal musicians have rejected the new metal label, and some have also rejected being labeled as heavy metal. So it's a whole thing, and it's a bummer, because you know that it's just elitist metal guys that are like, that's not metal, that's, I don't know, you know, get that rap music out of my metal.
Yeah, seriously, I don't know, it's metal,
it's just another, you know, sub-genre of it, or another fraction of it.
I mean, it's
it.
Got metal in the goddamn title, come on.
Well, yeah, definitely. So I wanted to read a few quotes, because I found some of these pretty interesting. So Rob Flynn had this to say. So this is reception and controversy regarding new metal. So Rob Flynn of Machine Head said this regarding the Burning Red. There's a minute and a half of rapping on that album. The other 53 minutes of the record are like a giant scar being ripped open while I project a vomit through it. If all that people got out of the Burning Red was rap metal, and they didn't fucking listen to it. Jonathan Davis, the vocalist of Korn, he spoke about the criticism of new metal from heavy metal fans, saying, there's a lot of closed-minded metal purists that would hate something because it's not true to metal or whatever. But Korn has never been a metal band, dude. We're not a metal band. We've always been looked at as what they call new metal thing. But we've always been the black sheep, and we never fit into that kind of thing. So we're always ever-evolving. We always piss fans off. And we're gaining other fans, and it is how it is. I mean, Jonathan Davis can call Korn whatever he wants to call them, but they're definitely a metal band.
Yeah.
Like, I get it. Korn's Korn. I get it.
Yeah, I mean, they're different enough. They're allowed to get away with stuff like their album Path to Totality, which is mostly just all, like, dubstep. Like, they're allowed to get away with that because they're Korn. And maybe they don't view it as, like, hey, we're not a metal band. We're not a new metal band because, like, they never tried to be a new metal band.
Right. They just were born.
Yeah. They did their thing. They happened to basically create new metal. They didn't realize it. And they're just like, hey, you know, we did what we thought we needed to do in the studio, and it turned out the way it did. And, you know, we're not new metal. You know, you just like, they're putting a label on us that we never really wanted in the first place. You know, we were never influenced by new metal, but we just, I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, I get that. So, Lamb of God's vocalist Randy Blythe, the Almighty Randy, he criticized the new metal genre and spoke out about its loss of popularity in 2004, saying, new metal sucks, so that's why that's dying off. And I think people are ready for angrier music. I think people are ready for something that's real, not, you know, I did it all for the nookie.
That's great. I love Dave that.
That's a funny quote. Dave Mustaine of Megadeth, of course, said he would rather have his eyelids pulled out than listen to new metal.
Wow.
Gary Holt, a member of the thrash metal band Exodus and Slayer, said that he was so glad about the decline of new metal. So, a lot of the old guard, it's not
like
fans,
salty old dudes.
Yeah, salty old dudes, just not at all appreciative of the new metal genre. Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails, he said he knows some of the Korn members and he thinks they're all cool guys, but he also criticized the genre, saying, when I'm asked what do I think of a lot of the new metal bands that are out there, my response is that it seems really insecure to me. I've had really shitty childhood, and I'm really upset, and I'm really ugly. I've put a lot of makeup on, and I'm harder and faster, and my voice sounds more like the Cookie Monster than yours does. To me, it all comes across as being comical, as being a parody of itself. I was reading that, and I thought he was talking about himself, but then I realized he was being sarcastic.
Oh, my God.
And I think some of some of it has to do with, like, Limp Bizkit, right? I mean, there's just some bands that really did not make nu metal look cool.
Right.
Yeah, it's just, this is funny, too. In response to reports that Fred Durst, lead singer of Limp Bizkit, is a big fan of Tool, the latter's vocalist, Maynard James Keenan, said, "If the lunch lady in high school hits on you, you appreciate the compliment, but you're not really going to start dating the lunch lady, are you?"
Oh my God. You know, the thing about it, coming from, like, anyone else, I would think that's, like, funny, but coming from Maynard of Tool, it's like, I know he's serious about that, and, like, that guy's just a dick.
He is a dick. So Limp Bizkit blew up, and Korn actually took Bizkit out on tour and helped with that process. So, like I said, I enjoy Limp Bizkit ironically. I think he has some jams that do make me smile, but, like, because I think Break Stuff is a pretty badass song. But, like, yeah, he's not very well respected at all.
Right. No.
And, we haven't even discussed Rage Against the Machine, which I think is definitely, like, a precursor to all of this stuff, too. But anyway. So, like I said, some bands like the label, others don't. In 2014, Davis spoke about the nu metal label, saying, "I've always rejected Korn's pigeonholing into some kind of genre that we help create. It seems like when a band comes out and we do something new and something different, that's all great. When a whole bunch of bands jump on the bandwagon and start copying what that one band did, then it gets called something, and those bands are cheap knockoffs of what the original thing was. So to me, that's why I never liked the nu metal term." So he clearly does not like this being classified like this.
I could understand. Or just like what I was saying earlier, is like they did their thing and happened to create, like, this new style of making music, and other people liked it and they emulated it, and therefore, like, a genre was created. I mean, that's how music genres are created.
That's true. Last one I'll read for you guys is Linkin Park's vocalist Chester Bennington, rest in peace, later expressed some disagreement with his band being labeled a heavy metal group because he felt the term limited the scope. Oh, there's an error on my quote, sorry. The term limited the scope of the band's actual style. He elaborated, "We wanted to make clear from the very beginning, when we were kind of tagged as a new metal band, not that we have anything against metal. We aren't just one thing. So there are elements of the band that are metal. There are elements of the band that are pop. There are elements that are electronic and hip-hop as well. And we've kind of felt like we weren't bound to just one genre. So after we made Hybrid Theory and Meteora, we really wanted to take risks beyond what we'd already done on those first two records creatively and show the world that we can do a lot more than just make new metal songs." Although, Chester, I got to correct you, you couldn't do it as well, because those albums weren't as good. But you tried.
That's true.
You tried. And rest in peace. But
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing with nu metal, though, is it's, like, really just a grab bag. Like, Chester's saying here, there are elements of pop, there are elements of electronic and hip-hop as well. Like, those are literally just part of the nu metal recipe, so you're not describing anything new.
Yeah, exactly. He's kind of literally just giving you the definition of nu metal. So, I think nu metal is, I mean, it's tough to classify, because you could just as well, maybe just as well, call it new something else. I don't know. It'd probably be harder to call it new hip hop, but, like, new metal is, it must be, like, they called it that because that's kind of what you feel is the main influence, because it's aggressive music. It's still got heavy guitars, but then it sprinkles in all these other elements. So I don't know. There's so much that you can talk about. And, like we both said, we're fans of Korn, but, you know, nu metal genre as a whole, and of course we like Slipknot and System of a Down, which I don't really view System of a Down quite as much a nu metal band.
No.
Although they do have interesting elements. I always view, like, funky hip hop is part of nu metal and has to be almost to make them nu metal.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I would say that's a very critical, like having hip hop elements is a critical aspect of nu metal for sure.
Yeah. And even like Slipknot's debut album, like to me, that's, I mean, of course it has like, you know, the electronic or the DJ kind of scratches and stuff in it. But I don't know. It's hard for me to buy in completely to the fact that that's a nu metal album, but at the same time, I can see it.
Yeah, I hear you, and I agree. It's like, it just kind of toes the line, I would say, for me.
Yeah. So anyway, I think at this point, we'll get into the songs of Korn's debut album, Korn. And we'll start with, of course, their first song on the album, which is Blind. And Korn kind of begins this. The song starts with the dueling riffs from Monkey and Head, and Jonathan Davis lets out his "Are you ready?" like he's on the shitter, but it's actually really badass.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, this is like that's like iconic, right? That's like, Jonathan Davis screaming "Are you ready?" on Blind is super iconic moment. One of the most iconic moments in metal. So Blind is mostly about Jonathan Davis's drug problems, mostly amphetamines. I think the band overall like did a like they all had, every member of the band had like addiction problems, and I think one of the biggest problems was with like meth. And the song was how he would personally feel all scattered and all over the place while he was under the influence. He felt blind.
He believed he was going blind. That's actually one of my favorite parts of the song. I believe I'm going blind. I believe. Was that one of the moments you were talking about where he kind of sounds like Anselmo or Vettery?
I think most of it is on, I think like Divine later in the albums. I think like Divine and Fake.
Okay.
If I'm remembering correctly.
A cool thing about that I read about Blind is the demo played on that Nademeyer's Mind. They actually played it on Blackie Lawless's guitar, and he was the guitarist for Wasp. And I don't know if they were recording in the same place, but they like snuck in and used his guitar to play.
What are they, the just demo like for Blind? They just like steal it?
Or just, I don't like, know. I think they were in the same studio. I'm not 100%. It seemed like they were in the same studio, and Wasp was gone, so they snuck into the studio and they used his guitar. So
his guitar is probably nicer or something.
Yeah, but of course, this is one of my favorite songs on the entire album. One of my favorite Korn songs. It's a great song. And that leads us into Balta! Oh, God.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I don't know what he's saying at all in this song, but the funny thing is I don't think he is either.
Most of the shit in the song is just utter garbage.
Yeah, so he told Metal Hammer that Ball Tongue, he didn't sing a goddamn word in that song. I couldn't describe what I wanted to do. So that's how it came out. It's a really heavy sound. Ball Tongue is about a man that had to work with Korn on a t-shirt design, and he either had a pierced tongue or had a wart on his tongue or something, and he gave Korn a really hard time. And I guess his nickname was Balta.
I think it was also, I read that it's like they did that because like when he was on drugs, he couldn't like talk and his like tongue would all get all like messed up. So
yeah, like ball up or whatever.
Yeah.
So that was part of his name. And I guess, like, another thing about this song is they convinced, what is it, Robinson, the producer?
Yep.
They convinced him to take them on a drug run, and he didn't know they were on a drug run until it was too late, and then he got pissed at him, but they actually recorded, like, some of the vocals of Ball Tongue while they were on drugs, which kind of makes sense that he didn't sing a goddamn word in that song.
Yep.
So, oh yeah, here's the quote. This is from Head. "We tricked Ross into taking us on a drug run, and then we ended up tracking the vocals for Ball Tongue high on drugs. When Ross found out that he drove us on a drug run without knowing it, he got pretty upset with us." So, and that's when Davis also mentions, "Went to my dealer, got a big old fat rock of meth, chopped that shit up, and I did vocals. Ball Tongue was about our close friend, like you mentioned. And when he was tweaking out on drugs, his tongue would kind of seize up. So he was Ball Tongue."
That's just not, because I think Head does some of the lyrics. I think he's actually the guy who yells. He's the guy who yells Ball Tongue. That's Head. And then, because it's like Ball Tongue, and then Jonathan Davis is like, hum, 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 and he does his scat vocals.
Well, we present you Ball Tongue.
It's a great song. So the third track is Need To, and Need To was the second single off the album. It was released in April of 95, that single. And this is the one we were talking about earlier, that their demo, basically the song Alive would become most of Need To, and then later on, Take a Look in the Mirror, they would steal some of like the other sections of the songs that they didn't use from the demo in some songs from Take a Look in the Mirror, which is, yeah, like I was saying, yeah, it is. I looked it up. It is 2003. So it was like almost 10 years later, probably 10 years later, right? The demo was like probably 93.
Yeah, I think the demo was released in 93.
So it's like 10 years later, they're using segments from their first release, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, pretty cool considering that release barely had any songs on it.
Yeah.
So anyway, this is Need To. So Need To spins the tale of the protagonist, conflicted about a relationship with another person. Why does he need to have this sexual relationship with her? There was rumors that it's about Jonathan Davis's thoughts about a friend's girlfriend that was cheating on Davis with... cheating on the friend with Davis. I got confused and I was trying to explain that. Jonathan Davis was sleeping with his friend's girlfriend. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yes. Right.
And it kind of just talks about that dynamic. So, I don't know. How do you feel about Need To?
I think it's okay. I think the chorus is interesting, where he's just like, "I hate you. I love you. Why is it you? Why do I cry?" And he's like, he's shouting that with like Head in the background, singing. I don't know. I think it's more or less for me kind of a, I'll listen to it if I'm like choosing to listen to this entire album, but I'm not going to come back to it.
I agree. My thoughts exactly. I think it flows well with the album, but you're coming back to Ball Tongue, or you're coming back to Blind.
Yep.
When you're listening to the front of the album.
Totally.
So that brings us to Clown. And this deals with an incident that happened in San Diego, California. A skinhead told Davis, "Go back to Bakersfield." And he attempted to hit Davis, but Davis dodged him. And the road manager, Jeff, I like how whoever Jeff is.
Jeff.
But old Jeff knocked the skinhead out.
Skinhead being probably like a neo-Nazi, right?
Yeah, that's what I was imagining. So we'll kick it into Clown. Clown.
I'm not from your town now. Hit me cut, because I'm not from your town now. Hit me cut, because I'm not from your town now. Hit me cut, because I'm not from your town now. Hit me clown!
So I had to look up those lyrics because I wasn't quite sure what the hell Davis was saying. But there's like two lines in the bridge there called where he says, "Hit me clown because I'm not from your town. Now hit me clown." That's the first line. And then he says, "Clown, you ain't shit. Turn around. Got your face split." That second line's a little easier to understand. But that first one, I was like, I don't know what the fuck Davis is saying. Probably more drugs.
Yeah, it's hard to understand. Hard to understand it, but I like this song. I think the song's a little more memorable than Need To.
Yes. No, I agree. I like the beginning segment where they're just all in the studio. Apparently Ross Robinson's big thing was like he recorded everything in that studio. And the beginning is basically the guys just hanging out in the studio. Apparently they played all of their tracks like together. Like they didn't like, they obviously mic'd all of their equipment up individually, right? But when they played the songs, they actually played them together when they recorded this album, which is like, I don't think, maybe it was common at the time, but certainly isn't common anymore.
No, I think that's unusual, definitely.
So that's kind of cool, kind of a interesting intro of the guys just sitting around getting pissed off at David S., not knowing whether or not to click in four times with his sticks or not.
Yeah, like I said, this one is above Knee Two, but still, I still put Blind and Ball Tongue above Clown. So, anyway, that brings us into Divine, and Jonathan Davis told Rock Hard that Divine was one of Korn's earliest songs, written at the legendary Buck Owens Studio in Bakersfield, California. My dad rented the studio for a long time. That's where the first Korn demos of Ball Tongue and Divine were created. The studio surrounds a great creative atmosphere. It's converted to ancient theater. It is speculated that the song got its title from Davis being a fan of the 300-pound transvestite actor Divine. I'm a big fan of Divine and his movies because they're so fucking horrible. He did Pink Flamingos and shit like that. That's a pretty sick movie. And just a fun fact, Rob Trujillo, then of Suicidal Tendencies, now of Metallica, he was involved in the writing of this song.
Nice. That's cool.
I have no idea why, but he was.
He's just around. He's like, hey, yo, Rob, come check this shit out.
Come check it out. And you guys check it out, too. Here's Divine. Fed up with you. What's good is your fuck no better than you. Fuck you. Fed up with you. What's good is your fuck no better than you. Fuck you. Fed up with you. I'm not as good as you. Fuck no one better than you. No, fuck you. I'm fed up with you. I'm not as good as you. Fuck no one better than you. No, fuck you. I'm fed up with you. I'm not as good as you. Fuck no one better than you. No, fuck you. I'm fed up with you. I'm not as good as you. Fuck no one better than you. No, fuck you. I'm fed up with you. I'm not as good as you. Fuck no one better than you. No, fuck you. I'm fed up with you. I'm not as good as you. Fuck no one better than you.
So that was the bridge / breakdown of that song. It's pretty awesome, pretty heavy. Probably one of the heavier moments on this album, I would say.
Definitely, I agree with you on that. Yeah, you said what part of this now is that? Is that the part that you were kind of getting Phil Anselmo or Eddie Vedder vibes?
I think the chorus a little bit, you know, where he holds out. You know, you're going to waste your time. You know, that's maybe a little bit of that, like, grungy aspect.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah.
I mean, I could see it. I've never thought of it before, but yeah, he does have some, like, grunginess to his voice, for sure.
It's definitely, like, higher pitch. Like, he doesn't go for, like, the low grungy, you know, but...
Yeah, exactly.
He's definitely higher.
So that brings us to Faggot, which I feel like I can't say because of today's political culture. But that's the name of the song. I'm not, you know, I don't mean nothing by it.
No slurs or anything. It's just the name of the song.
The lyrical themes are about lead vocalist Jonathan Davis, his time in high school where he was bullied relentlessly by jocks, those damn jocks. I'm just imagining, like, the stereotypical, like, greasers and the Letterman jacket wearing jocks, you know, like.
Well, he's probably from a big high school, and this was like the 80s, right? Like, they were definitely wearing Letterman's jackets for sure.
Yeah. So he was bullied because he was goth, like we said, and he's wearing eyeliner, listening to New Wave, you know, enjoying the arts. He was just a goth kid. And he was constantly called names like fag or faggot because those were, I guess, more common terms. I don't want to say terms of endearment, but like more common derogatory terms back then.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan Davis talked about the song in an interview saying, "There's a big rumor about me being a homosexual. Does it really matter? I have lots of gay friends. It shouldn't matter. I was in the new romantic scene in high school with Duran Duran, which was his favorite band, and he was wearing makeup. I got called a fag by the jocks. Couldn't walk through the halls without hearing that or being picked on." Well, who's laughing now, jocks? Who's laughing now? Suck it. Here's Faggot.
So that particular section was the chorus of Faggot. Overall, I actually really like this song. I think it's pretty good.
Yeah, I definitely prefer this song over the previous two. I think it's right up there for me with Ball Tongue and Blind. So we'll move right on to a truly iconic Korn song, and that is Chutes and Ladders, which is pretty much a live staple. It's kind of about how many of the nursery rhymes have dark meanings. It explores the concepts of nursery rhymes, and Davis says that it uncovers the hidden messages in nursery rhymes, the first songs many of us ever hear. Chutes and Ladders, to set the record straight, calls out nursery rhymes for what they really are. I choose each rhyme for a different reason. Baba Black Sheep has racist overtones. London Bridge talks of all the people of London dying from the Black Plague, as does Ring Around the Roses. Then there's Little Red Riding Hood. One of the stories tells of we all know that the story of Riding Hood tells the story of the wolf basically raping Red Riding Hood and killing her. So just a dark twist on some nursery rhymes that are kind of not perceived darkly at all, really. So Chutes and Ladders.
Chutes and Ladders begins with Jonathan Davis playing the bagpipes, because of course he plays bagpipes. Why wouldn't he? Why would he not? I think I've seen Korn 3 or 4 times live, and they have done this song every single one. I think they've started every single set with Blind, so which is really cool, because like for this being their first album, I don't know that there's that many bands that play like songs off their first album like Korn does.
No, not many. And all the ones that do are usually pretty great bands, you know? So,
right.
Yeah, I remember when we saw them live and they played Chutes and Ladders. It plays super well live, and just another unique element that how many metal bands or whatever you want to call Korn, how many bands have bagpipes featured in them, you know, not many. And just the way that this song is such a goofy song with the nursery rhymes, you know, but it's still heavy as fuck.
One, I know when they recorded, I think they actually recorded the bagpipes for the song, like outside, like they literally put a microphone outside so you can hear, at the very beginning, it sounds like it's being recorded outside and there's like birds chirping and shit. That's because it was literally actually recorded outside. And, the recording studio is like in this cabin that's pretty isolated. Like you have to drive up, I think like up a mountain to get there. And, like Davis, like literally like walked down the road and walked closer and closer to the microphone. So it's got like, the reason why it sounds like it's being recorded up on top of a mountain is because it like literally was.
On top of a mountain. Bagpipes and flutes.
Seven string guitars. Top of a mountain.
This is, oh man. It's hard. This is probably my favorite song on the album. It's that or Blind, to be honest with you.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. Between this and Blind, it's difficult to pick. I might if I want to show someone Korn, like I might go to Chutes and Ladders. Be like, hey.
Right.
Like, yeah. It gets a little weird, so I'm just going to start you off with something that's pretty like weird. Like maybe a little bit like out of left field, not necessarily weird, but definitely like love this song. It's a great song.
Also, just want to throw out there that Korn fucking brings it live and they still rock live.
Yes.
They are a must-see.
Must-see.
Predictable. This was producer Ross Robinson called. I think it was in Denver. They opened for Ozzy, and nobody really knew who they were. I think it was during Predictable. John started wigging the fuck out so hard, like so hard. I've never, ever in my entire life seen anything like it, ever. Flailing his body and his arms, he was just out of his mind. The whole crowd stood up, started cheering. It was one of the most incredible things I've ever seen in my life. And it was during a music part. He wasn't even singing. That's when I knew it was on. And this was also on the aforementioned demo, misspelled as Redactable or whatever they spelled it as. So, yeah, let's kick it to Predictable.
Predictable to me, this is like the song where you get a lot of the grunge influence in Davis's vocals. He's got like, I don't know, there's not many other songs where he just kind of consistently has this like 90s grunge timbre when he's singing the whole song. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah, no, I can see that. And I don't know, from Predictable, Fake, and Lies, I do enjoy all these songs, but I don't know. They're ones that I only listen to when I'm listening to the album as a whole, I guess. So, definitely a good song, though. And I just got to mention, though, from when you first start hearing Korn on this album, it's just immediately evident that you're in for a good trip because the mix is so great. The drumming, they even mentioned how David S.'s drumming, how he played actually along with Davis's vocals rather than the click track, really.
Oh.
So he would like get quiet. He would play off the energy of Davis's vocals, and Ross has even said, the producer, that if he went and tried to fix the drums, he would ruin the entire album because if he tried to like change the levels or whatever,
yeah,
it wouldn't work. It wouldn't work. And you immediately start to hear, you know, feel these iconic bass playing where he's just slapping the living shit out of the bass.
Yep.
Like, it's great, though. It's such a unique sound. You immediately know. Or if you didn't know, you're going to know that that's Fieldy playing bass. So,
I think it's, that's just like, yeah, every single, like literally every single aspect. Like, I didn't even consider, I'm gonna have to like re-listen to that. Like, I'm gonna have to re-listen to this album and like the rest of the albums that David was on and like listen for that, because that's really interesting. That basically means that every single aspect of Korn had like this, yeah, I mean, there's like this really unique, this like really unique vibe to it, with like you were saying, the energy of the drums matches the energy of the vocals. Obviously Jonathan Davis is an incredibly iconic and recognizable vocalist. You got Fieldy slapping the bass, and you got like these heavy down-tuned guitars that do these weird turntable scratches and stuff. It's like everything they've got going on is like mega unique.
One could even say that it is far from fake, which is our next song.
Ooh, nice.
I wanted to really work on a really corny transition. So it's a pretty straightforward song. It's just it's literally one of those songs it's about fake people. Never really released as a single, but as a Just So You Know, it was included on the flip side of the UK Blind vinyl single and included on a CD that came with the May 1996 issue of Metal Hammer magazine. Here is Fake. I can still. Just a scared to be you inside.
So one thing that's I like about Fake is that I feel like it's an early glimpse of like this particular type of vocal that Jonathan Davis delivers, in that he's got like this very like timid singing voice, you know what I mean?
Definitely.
I think this is, if I'm remembering correctly, like this is like one of the first instances that this happens on this album, and it definitely becomes a staple of his vocal delivery. One of the, of course, many different things he does, but that particular delivery is pretty iconic.
I think the only thing that we're missing on this album is he doesn't do like a full on like, you know, like,
yeah,
he does a little bit on Baltung.
And
does he do it anywhere else that I'm missing?
I believe no. I mean, maybe here and there, but yeah, definitely like Baltung, he does it like as a note, you know, like he does it specifically.
Yeah, and it's not even like how he'll drag it out in later albums.
Right.
One of my favorite ones is the iconic, his iconic one from, why am I forgetting the name of that song? Freak on a Leash. The most iconic one, version of him doing that. But one of my favorites is on See You on the Other Side on the song Liar.
Oh, and yeah, that's a good one. He gets like real deep for that one.
Right? Yeah, he's like, but that's pretty good. And nobody else can do that but him. But if I do that, I sound like a freaking idiot.
Right. Knowing, it's only Jonathan Davis can pull that shit off.
And that is No Lies, which is our next song.
Oh,
God. So it was never. Also never officially released as a single. It was included on a low-priced compilation issued by Epic Records in 1994 to promote their up-and-coming bands at the time. So, interesting that they would choose Lies. That was kind of the year that the album was released. So, anyway, here's the song Lies.
So I think this is the album that when, or this is the song that when I listen to it, really feels like I was mentioning earlier, Static X feels like it's like there's a lot of Korn influence. Like this song in particular sounds like Static X was influenced by it specific, like a lot, like especially the vocal delivery and the way the vocals sound. It's very much, very much Static X.
Shouts to you, Static X people out there. So we'll move on to the. This would be the penultimate song, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
Helmet in the Bush. So this was about Davis's drug abuse and the fear that gripped him at the height of his drug problem. He pleaded for a divine intervention to deliver him from his nightmare as if he cannot help himself. Davis explained, I'd wake up in the morning and do a line to get out of bed, speed in the morning. I'd have it all lined up for breakfast, so when I'd lay down and go to sleep, I'd wake up and just snort it, and it's like, yeah, okay, I'm up. It was bad. Like, you do one line and stay up all night, but then you have to shit. You have shit to do the next day, so you have another line to do to be able to keep staying up to get that shit done. Eventually, you start spinning out from sleep deprivation. You get hallucinations and shit like that. Davis said that Helmet in the Bush is about meth. It's about when you do meth and you look down at your dick and it's literally a helmet in the bush. basically, it's what happens when you do too much drugs and your girl want to get with you and you've got some man problems down below. Just another reason not to do drugs, children. Fieldy elaborated. Anyway. Oh, yeah, you put some quotes in here, too, that I'll read. Robinson said, the producer, I think the drum machine inflected Helmet in the Bush. John and Brian put it together themselves. I think Brian played all the guitars on it as well. On that song, after we've done most of the album, he was playing really, really good. I was like, dude, why were you playing so soft on everything else? He goes, I didn't want it to go out of tune. I'm like, what? I wasn't experienced enough to just know. I just thought, oh, he's just not a good guitar player. I went back and redid all the guitars. So... That's interesting.
That like blew my mind. Like apparently Head was like playing gently on all of the other tracks because he didn't want his guitar to go out of tune during recording. So like when him and Davis recorded this song, he just like went for it and they had to like re-record all the guitars. Like what?
Yeah, crazy. That is pretty crazy. So anyway, here's Helmet in the Bush.
So the main riff for the song is pretty goddamn righteous. That was like the chorus section. You got these like whispering, you got this like grunty Davis, right? Kind of got a little 90s voice action going on, but then there's this like these creepy whispers happening in the background, you know, want to give it up. No, I can't escape. Obviously about, you know, drugs and getting off of it and stuff like that. But yeah, this song's got a pretty righteous riff.
Definitely. So, that brings us to the last song on the album, which is Daddy. And this is known for a lot. I guess, I mean, it's a good song, but it's known also for just, like, how emotional it is and the length and how Robinson just kind of let the mics go like you were talking about, and everything was just so raw in the studio. So... Daddy, that's the album's longest track, saw Jonathan Davis descending very real tears. Davis said that the song's concept deals with his childhood, saying, people think Daddy was written because my father abused me. But that's not what the song's about. When I was a kid, I was being abused by someone else. I don't really like to talk about that song. Some 14 minutes into Daddy, well after the song has ended, a hidden track begins to play. The hidden track depicts an argument between a man and his wife over a Dodge Dart carburetor. Robinson... For Daddy, I remember just telling John, you know what to do. That's all I said. Davis, it was just a special moment that I did not know was being recorded, for one, because Ross is a prick and kept the fucking tape running. Robinson, and it's all live, no overdubs. Head, It was one of the most intense things I've ever witnessed in my life. It was so crazy. I thought he was joking at first because he was really bawling and everything, but it was very, very intense. David S. When we ended the song, Jonathan was still crying. I could see him through the window from the drum booth. He was actually on the floor crying, and Ross was in the control room, talking in our ears, going, "Keep going," making a rolling motion with his hand, so we just kept going. Davis. That's me throwing my headphones and slamming the door on the fucking vocal booth. Robinson. You'll hear the door creaking at the very end, and the tape rolls off the machine. I put a delay on that last little bit of tape, and we mixed it. We had to mix it, letting the tape roll off like that. One of the most powerful things I've ever experienced, and James continuing the song with the sobbing, they were so good at jamming. The whole long ending is just a jam. The engineer, Chuck Johnson, was so great, and not thinking about pressing stop on the tape machine. Davis, and I remember that moment when I came out of here, and I was fucking sobbing, my whole band was crying, they all just hugged me and shit. It was a fucking crazy experience. It was the good old days, dude. We were all in a band of brothers, we were like the fucking Three Musketeers. Everybody was there for all their parts. Now we got families and shit, we're growing up, so everybody comes and does their own parts and leaves. But at that point, the whole band was there, except for David. He never was there. He always did his parts and bailed. Fieldy. I remember crying on that song. I was just crying on how heavy and powerful the song was, and it just made me emotional. Without further ado, I guess we gotta just get into the daddy.
You fucking ruined my life! You fucking daddy!
Pretty crazy that like it's just a jam, you know?
Yeah, and it's one of those songs that like I think it's iconic for like how much Jonathan Davis put into it and all the shit he's been through in his life.
Yep.
It's like, it's a great Korn song, or I guess, but like, it's not one I ever come back to.
Right. Right.
It's just one of those you listen to maybe once or twice in your life and you're like, okay, I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even Jonathan Davis, you know, they've only performed this song live like one or two times.
Well, I think right before this interview, right after this interview that we're reading from Rolling Stone, it's like they performed it for the first time in like, you know, like 15 or 20 years, you know, like,
yeah.
It's like they never do that song.
Yeah. And it's like Davis said it, but obviously something traumatic happened in his past.
Yeah,
and I don't think he's ever publicly called anybody out, because I know the person who did whatever they did to him is dead. That's right. All he's ever
yeah,
said.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. I remember reading
but
that.
But he's never really pointed a finger at anybody other than saying it's not his dad, which I think it's fair. I mean, I don't blame people for assuming that.
I mean, it's called Daddy, and he referenced like, Mom, why didn't you help me? So yeah, I mean, totally.
I mean, you know, people who usually abuse are somebody you're close to. So I'm guessing is a family member or a friend, but either way, really shitty thing, but I'm sure it's one of those tracks that a lot of people who had been through abuse connected to and kind of looked at as like, okay, you know, I'm not alone, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we made it through all the tracks. It's definitely worth a listen through. And I hadn't listened to this album in a long time, and I really enjoyed listening to it front to back. I listened to it front to back probably 3 to 5 times, and it really holds up. I really do think there's not really any filler on this album. It's just one of those things where I probably only come back to, like, Blind, Voltongue, Chutes and Ladders. You know, I come back to basically the most popular songs on this album.
Yep.
But, like I said, my own personal reasoning, is that, you know, Issues is a more important album for me personally, because that's the first Korn album I heard, and See You on the Other Side has a lot of nostalgia tied into high school, and I just love for some reason, I love every song on See You on the Other Side, like, just very singable album, or a very good album in that way. But that doesn't take anything away from Korn's original album. It set the stage for nu metal and this whole new wave of bands that came in, for better or for worse, whatever your thought is on it. Korn still stands apart from all those bands, though, for sure.
No, I agree. It's I don't know. I'm glad that you know, Head's departure in you know, for probably like what, I think like almost 10 years, like 8 years from like 2003 to 2011 or something like that, some time frame like that, he was gone, and but now he has returned, and the band has released a couple albums, and their most recent album is good, and I don't know, they're still going strong. Jonathan Davis's last most recent or debut solo record is also very excellent, so go check that out too.
Definitely. And yeah, as far as their new album, I really love the song Rotten in Vain. I know that was one of the singles, but that is a fucking badass song.
Oh yeah. Yeah. They still know how to write riffs, that's for sure.
Yeah, Davis lets out some pretty awesome screams on that song too. So I like the updated Korn as well. You know, they don't sound as much like this anymore, but I like bands that evolve, and I'm sure, you know, Korn wants to try to push the envelope every album too, so.
Of course.
So yeah, thank you guys for listening to this in context about the debut Korn album. You can send us, you know, let us know what you think, supermetalworld@gmail.com. We have our website, www.supermetalworld.com. Go check out our articles, our other podcasts. We're available anywhere you stream music. Please rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Spotify, follow us on all our social media, spread the word, and yeah, Korn fucking rules. So, Korn's high, everyone.
Horns high.